Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA.
If history is the collective passion of a people, it is also the saga of individual lives in tension and harmony. And when the lives in question are the two considered closest to the 20th century's greatest president, it is important to understand clearly what roles they played and how their influence may have affected the course of American society. When the strong characters of Sarah Delano and Eleanor Roosevelt intertwined, a gripping American story was written. It may not, however, be the one we think we know. My guest is Jan Potker, author of Sarah and Eleanor. Jan Potker, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Jan, your book, which reads novelistically because it engages the reader so, is written really as a kind of powerful refutation to what we think we know of Sarah Delano. And popularly, as your preface even points out, she's portrayed pretty much as a monster or ogre. The first question, therefore, is why is that so?
Why is she referred to as an ogre? It is a misunderstanding that Americans have had for decades, probably for the last half century, that Sarah Delano Roosevelt was a domineering, disagreeable, contentious mother-in-law to Eleanor Roosevelt and a domineering mother to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when she was none of those things. I believe the myth got started as Eleanor herself became older, became ill, changed the truth of her early story a little, and also was truly harmed by the play Sunrise at Campobello by Doris Sherry.
She was influenced by that play.
She was portrayed in that play as just the most awful woman. Sarah Delano Roosevelt appears in 9 of 11 scenes, and she's disagreeable in every one of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we have taken away from us, that memory.
The Delano fortune, the fortune of that Sarah would inherit, come into, that really was the making of the family, has a very interesting origin. And let's be blunt. It has to do a lot with the China trade, but particularly with the China trade in opium. I guess I'll just cut to the chase on this question, Jan Potker. How was that handled by the family? I mean, that's opium, that's dope. And of course, these are aristocrats in America.
That's dope. I think they did not want to look at it, and I'm not sure they still did. It's still, when I talk to some of the Roosevelt relatives alive today, they justified it by saying, well, the opium started, you know, the Delano started making their fortune in opium after tea was no longer making money. They probably would have stuck with tea had they continued to make a fortune in it. But that wasn't possible after the 1840s. So they turned to opium, as did many other American people in the ship trade. But they say it was needed for the Civil War, for the relief of soldiers' pain. Well, yes, that's true. I'm sure some was supplied to the Union soldiers because that's who the Delanos were sympathetic to. But it was also, you know, brought in. The Chinese used it. It was illegal in China. It was illegal in England.
Exactly. You know, you remind me as you speak that, and where the Delano explanation founders a bit is that at one point, I believe the family fortunes take a nosedive. And then they're revived, I think, by just going right back into the business. Is that right?
Exactly.
So that's hard to associate with, you know, a lot of doing good for injured soldiers.
That's absolutely right. In fact, they had a myth for a long time that they had a contract that Abraham Lincoln had signed, but it seems to be a myth. No one has actually seen this contract in modern days.
Sarah Delano Roosevelt, eventually Roosevelt, was born on the 21st of September, 1854, Jan Potker. Seventh child of Warren and Catherine, her parents. The country into which she was born, our country, was at that point aggressively, we might say, moving into its manifest destiny phase and its fast expansion and all the rest of it. How do you think that the spirit of the age, so to speak, influenced her youth and further personality?
I believe that Sarah Delano Roosevelt was very much, George C.A., influenced by the tremendous growth of the country and the feeling that One is egalitarian. Her father, who was a Unitarian, by the way, said that he wrote in a letter that he was supporting Abraham Lincoln, but he felt that Lincoln might not be doing enough for the colored man. Mm-hmm. Now, this is probably an unusual point of view before the Civil War, but that's the type of man her father was. And I think she saw this as she grew up and was influenced by the tremendous growth in the country when she married her husband, who was in railroads and banking and so forth. Just the thought that America can be great, America can get over whatever its problems are and continue growing. And I think that's what she passed on to FDR, her son.
You mentioned her marriage, and that brings us right to a very important point, certainly the next landmark in her life. This is James Roosevelt, a man who's 30 years her senior, I believe, 56
yes.
to 26, if I recall correctly. And he is a widower. Rebecca, his first wife, has died and left him a son from that marriage. Now, Hyde Park, I believe, enters our story at this point. And this is important because if you read this story straight through, Hyde Park is as much a personage as any of the living people, I thought. But to get to James Roosevelt first and this marriage, it cannot be easy, especially among a very prominent, wealthy family, to step into a household that's been someone else's. What does that tell us about her?
Strong woman, incredibly strong woman. Compare her, if you will, to the figure of literature, Rebecca, to the second Mrs. Max de Winter, who couldn't get over the first wife, Rebecca, you remember that. She stepped into that marriage, and Rebecca even dominated their relationship, as it turned out very tragically. That did not happen with Sarah. Sarah stepped into Hyde Park. And thank you for pointing out that Hyde Park is a thing in itself. I think those of us who have been fortunate enough to go to Hyde Park and see that house understand how much it made up FDR's fiber. But she stepped into Hyde Park and she didn't redecorate it and she didn't rearrange it, and she slept in the same bed that her new husband James had slept in with his late wife, and she adjusted her way to his, which is, in a sense, the Victorian way of a woman doing things. Mm. And perhaps some of our listeners wish that it were more so that way today,
yes.
Particularly the male ones.
FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, is born on the 30th of January, 1882. And now there is a stepson she has, Rosie, I think he's called.
Yes.
Roosevelt.
Yes, Roosevelt.
Uh-huh.
Few people know FDR had a half-brother,
yeah.
But he did.
But this child, FDR, is, well, I guess there's only one phrase to use. He's going to be the light of her life. Is that true right from the start? I mean, that birth and childhood, what's it like?
I believe so. First, she was an unusual woman. Sarah Delano Roosevelt was strong. She slayed. She skated. She was very physically active for a woman of her era, and through pregnancy, doing these active outdoor winter sports until practically the moment FDR was born, was a difficult birth. Mm-hmm. The doctor said, do not have any more children. If she were going to love a child, this was the child she had. And indeed, she was from a warm family, again, as you mentioned, 11 children, although only, I think, 5 lived to adulthood. But she was from a large family, a loving family. It was only natural. Family connections were very important to the Victorians. They didn't have outside friends in the sense that we have today. It was family you were friends with. It was family you married, as a matter of fact.
You know, it's interesting. Our mention, I guess both of us have done it or will do it, and that's the reference to the Victorian age, because it very much is kind of the founding or surrounding circumstance of our time. But it occurs to me that this woman, in particular, represents a transitional age, doesn't she? I mean, that's the age, the era in which she's born, and she's going to go right into the New Deal era.
Absolutely.
Next to her son.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And not only does she make that transition, but her daughter-in-law is Eleanor Roosevelt.
It says it all. I'm going to move us right now. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt again, because let's move into a comparison and a contrast and a consideration, I should say, of the two women. And here's a little motif I thought of as a way of doing it.
It was interesting to me reading this book how the motif of the sea and ships plays constantly into it. There's an enormous, there's the sea trade, of course, itself, shipping interests and part of the families. But there are incidents aboard ships that I think might help us define the two women right from the start. Let me pose two questions. The first concerns Sarah Delano, who I believe on a trip to China is aboard a ship that in a trough of a wave gets overwhelmed by a huge overflowing wave that must be terrifying because you're in an enclosed claustrophobic space and all this water cascades in. And if I recall correctly, her reaction was pretty phlegmatic to that.
Yes. Her mother always said that she didn't look for trouble. The mother didn't, and she taught that to the children. So the ship goes over. The mother is brave. She's there alone with her children, except for a sister she had with her. In other words, the husband was in China already. And she's got these children, some of whom are very ill. And the ship rights itself, and everyone is fine again. And they play on the deck, and they swing, and they have animals to feed them. You brought everything with you when you traveled in that era. And they threw bean bags rather than balls so they wouldn't lose them. For Sarah, it was a terrific experience that she taught to FDR. Mm-hmm. She sang sea chanties to him when he was a boy. I mean, what boy had a mother like this, mm-hmm. who had been on a ship to China when she was 6 or 7 years old? Great experiences, loved it. Came back the same way, of course, and told her son all about it.
And when she told about that particularly harrowing incident, it seems to me her reaction was pretty deadpan, pretty...
Yes.
Yeah, that's what happened, and it righted itself, sort of thing.
That's right. And you get on with life.
You get on with life. And I guess what I'm reading into that is a pretty secure personality and a pretty serene personality bred to it, but that's probably also her character or her nature. Now I want to contrast that in my second question to what the book tells us is Eleanor Roosevelt's earliest memory at age 2, which is on another ship, obviously, and another incident, a horrific incident. It's a collision at sea, and dozens of people are killed and maimed. I mean, there's a horrible incident there about some children and what their fate. But that is, for understandable reasons, that is a horrible image for her. And it seems to me that the fear and the insecurity it represented for her was emblematic of what her life might be like.
That's a brilliant point. I wish I had made it more directly in my book, but that is absolutely brilliant. Yes, it's Eleanor's first memory. She's in a horrible accident at sea. She's fearful. She's handed off. They try and put her into a boat. Her father tries to grab her. She won't release the sailor's arms who's holding her. She hangs on and she screams and screams and screams. Then she finally does get into this little rowboat, is taken to safety. And as soon as her parents land in England, they decide it's best for her if she leaves them and they go on vacation without her. Mm. So it's fear, it's horror, it's abandonment.
Mm. I think I'd rest on my laurels.
But really, you're absolutely right. It contrasts how these two women, and mm-hmm. people do not realize this is how Eleanor was when she was younger.
Right.
She was insecure. She was afraid.
Exactly. And you know, both these stories are absolutely compelling, gripping. She had also the disadvantage, I believe her father's name was Elliot.
Yes.
These names repeat themselves endlessly in the Roosevelt family.
Endlessly.
But he was perhaps a charming man, but a thoroughly unfortunate one with his drinking habits and his dissolute ways. She nonetheless adored him.
She did.
And what's it like to adore someone who's just not there?
Well, I don't know. I've never had that personal experience. Mm. But I can imagine that much of her early life, she said, was fantasy. Mm-hmm. She fantasized. She imagined herself after her, jumping ahead a little, but her father died when she was young. She imagined him alive. Mm-hmm. She would go out on the playground and pretend he was playing with her. It was not very healthy. And her adoration of her father when he would leave her because he would get drunk and leave her outside the club and not come out and forget about her and go home, and they would have to send her home in a cab. The doorman would send her home in a cab when he would actually drive her drunk. Now, this is in a buggy, mm-hmm. horse and buggy, but it was just as terrifying for her. When he would give her his word, he would appear and then not appear because mm-hmm. he was drunk and hadn't remembered it, or he was with a mistress, another mm-hmm. woman, whatever it is. All I can think about a little bit is how Jackie Kennedy Onassis, had a very similar father, and how she adored him, too.
I want to come back to that at the very conclusion. Let me take a moment, though, from our conversation to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. My guest is Jan Potker, author of Sarah and Eleanor. Jan, I'd like to turn to the endlessly fascinating personality of FDR for a moment in terms of many things. He was that sunny smile and that jaunty cigarette. Even people who weren't there seemed to know him because of that. How much of that was bred in the bones? I'm talking about his sense of the maternal love he might have gotten from Sarah Delano Roosevelt, the love of history that I think he was associated with even as a child, and maybe most interestingly in terms of the family tradition, the sense of public service.
I think much of that was bred in the bones, and thank God for that. Mm-hmm. Because without that courage, I mean, he was jaunty, and he had his cigarette holder at an angle, and he was in pain.
Yes.
Terrible mm-hmm. pain. And he had deep worries, as most people did in the Depression and World War II. But he took responsibility for those things. And if he hadn't been brought up in a family whose parents, actually his father was a Democrat, mm-hmm. although his mother came from Republican roots during the Lincoln time, she became a Democrat when she married her husband. The father was a Democrat. Public service was part of what you did. The father had been asked, James Roosevelt, to run for office at different times in his life, up to a congressional office. The half-brother, Rosie, had played around a little bit at doing some public service, but certainly on Eleanor's side, there was a huge amount of public service, and that's just something he admired in his fifth cousin, Theodore Roosevelt.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
The public service aspect, and he started thinking about being president when he was a boy at Groton.
Yes, that is stunning. Actually, it's kind of warming, heartwarming to see that, because you want him to be president as you read this book. But it's also true, you know, that in this family sense, this may well be, I think probably is, the most remarkable political family in American history.
Absolutely.
Because you have these two powerhouse clans, one in Oyster Bay and then one in Hyde Park, one Republican and one Democrat. And it's just amazing the sense of public service and talent. There are a couple of things, or many things we could go into, but when you think of all of that, the type of politics he was famous for, and of course the marriage and family relationships, which we're most concerned with at the moment, here's something I found very interesting. When he marries Eleanor, he gets not only a different set of eyes and ears on the country, but a kind of a different pulse taker of the country. Also someone who can show him things he might not have seen himself. I'll use two phrases. She is animated, they all are really, by, quote, a sense of duty. And at one point she takes him to a tenement where she's teaching. And he says, and I quote, "I didn't know people lived like that."
That's right.
I think this book volume is about the kind of relationship they had, what she saw and helped him to see, etc.
And one thing that I find as a woman so attractive about FDR is that I think he fell in love with her partly because of her intellect and her caring, and that she opened up worlds for him. Mm-hmm. He had that intelligence, but he hadn't been exposed to it. Yes, Sarah did good work and good things, but she didn't introduce her son to, she gave money mm-hmm. To some of the early social work networks in Manhattan, but she didn't personally introduce her son to that type of life the way Eleanor did. Mm-hmm. And he loved Eleanor for it.
Yeah. To speak of Sarah and her interests, which, as we said earlier, might surprise a lot of people, you're quite right. She did things sort of in the process of doing other things, I mean, demonstrate her interest, perhaps not in the overtly activist way that Eleanor might have done. But it's pretty astounding. For example, let's take her dedication to civil rights, which she put her money where her mouth was. I mean, Mary McLeod Bethune, a name that people should know but probably don't, a major African-American woman of the time, educator and leader, was very strongly supported by her. And I'm talking about a lot of money as well as personal support.
Absolutely. And she taught, when I say that Sarah Delano Roosevelt taught Eleanor, to give you an example is when Mrs. Bethune and other important women came to Sarah and Eleanor's shared home, Brownstone, which we may talk about. And Mrs. Bethune was the only woman of color in that group. And lunch was served. In lunch, there were no place settings. And so all the white women, including Eleanor, stopped for a second because they realized they might have to sit next to Mrs. Bethune. And they did not want to do that, or at least they were uncomfortable doing that. And Eleanor froze, too. She realized what the problem was. She didn't know what to do about it. So Sarah stepped into the breach, put her arm around Mrs. Bethune, and said, "Mrs. Bethune, would you sit, take the place of honor between my daughter-in-law and myself?" Perfectly resolving the issue, giving her the place of honor, making the other women comfortable at the same time, and honoring this great woman who was doing so much for people of her race.
Mm-hmm. And that's not the only time that she would so demonstrate. You mentioned the houses. There's so much to go into. I'm just going to, obviously, how she dealt with this rather extensive family is very important. And the brownstones in New York have a lot to do with this, because you would have families, that is to say, generations of families living next to each other, right, with connecting houses.
Yes, it was very common. When people think about the fact that Sarah had a house that joined Eleanor and Franklin's house, they think that of this in modern terms. It was pretty common back then, particularly if you were a family of wealth, mm-hmm. to live right by or with your relatives.
Mm-hmm. The biggest, let me put it this way, the most powerful theme, I thought, in this consideration of Sarah Delano Roosevelt, her true nature and relationship, again, putting one's money where one's mouth is the continuing substantial, enormous, really, subsidies, financial subsidies she gave to Franklin and Eleanor and indeed many other relatives right through the White House years.
Yes. In fact, she was gifting FDR $100,000 for White House costs. Mm-hmm. Now, when people say Sarah didn't want him to be president, it's hard for me to understand how she could have not wanted him to have been president, have been against him being president, and given him this type of money. Mm-hmm. Having been the largest, she was the largest supporter of his earliest mm-hmm. political campaigns.
But you know, John, there is one aspect of her charity and philanthropy and generosity that left me thoughtful, and that is the way she would continually give gifts to the kids, the children, and generally not tell the parents about it. Now, there are different ways of reading this, and she would always, it seems to me, confess great surprise and chagrin when it came out, but it yes. kept doing it. I mean,
and it angered Eleanor.
It certainly did. And, you know, I could understand, quite frankly, why that would.
I can understand why it would anger Eleanor. In a sense, and I don't mean to criticize Eleanor, but to stand back from it, in a sense, Eleanor should have expected it because Eleanor took these gifts from Sarah. Mm-hmm. And when Sarah gave them to the grandchildren, why wouldn't the grandchildren take them? Eleanor and Franklin had taken them and never doubted the gift, never refused it.
That's true, and I'll enter... Other points on Sarah's side might be that Eleanor had many gifts, but the maternal gift was not one of them. In terms of child raising, it doesn't seem. I mean, there's one incident in the book where she considers giving a child fresh air accomplished through hanging a cage out the window.
Putting baby Anna into the cage you would geraniums.
That was a little surprising. I mean, a truly admirable. I love her memory, but that is clearly something that she wasn't particularly good at, it seems. There's another aspect to many of the people in this book, and certainly their era, that the modern reader should be taken aback by. There's an awful lot of what I call breezy anti-Semitism. And, I mean, the kind of reference, offhand references, and not just anti-Semitism, racist comments to other groups, even from Eleanor at certain points, and even from people that you otherwise like, it seems, yes, to be just, again, perhaps bred in the bones.
Yes, unfortunately, and very dismaying. And I don't know if this has happened to you, George C.A., but I will be watching an old movie, and something will, there'll be a character come on or a reference to a character who is not white, and it's a slur in some way, and I'm still shocked and taken aback. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, I hope we've come a long way for us to be shocked at this.
I think we have. I love Turner Classic Movies. One of the reasons I liked watching them is precisely not that I'm a masochist, but it's interesting to see how the movies are, in many ways, time capsules in our movie-crazy society. If you look at the movies in the 30s, I'm digressing, I know, but it's interesting to see how the various groups were typecast.
Yes.
You know, an Asian American, an African American, a Jewish American would play, quote, appropriate roles. But anyway, it's just interesting see how even people we like could do that. Well, Jan Potker, I obviously liked the book, and I wouldn't want other people to read it. So I guess the concluding question is why we want them to read it. And maybe I could phrase it this way. Our principal character, our protagonist, Sarah Delano Roosevelt, died about 10 days short of her 87th birthday, I understand. And then, as if this weren't mythic enough, an enormous oak crashes to the ground on the Hyde Park estate, which must have been astounding. So, with all of that, and that kind of mystical ending, if you will, what does her story leave us? Why is it important to know about her true story?
She shaped Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and she shaped Eleanor Roosevelt. I think she was the strongest female influence on Eleanor Roosevelt. And I do, as you say, believe that Sarah Delano Roosevelt represented an era, the transition from the Victorian to the modern era, and helped us move into that era, helped America do that.
Jan Potker, thank you very much for being with us on Dialogue today. The book is Sarah and Eleanor. It's published by St. Martin's Press.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Jan Potker, author of Sarah and Eleanor. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.